I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So let's talk the Munster years. When did rugby become your number one sport? Because I know you were sports mad. The Tipperary Hurlers were on your radar as well at one stage.
Yeah, I think growing up, I played soccer, I played hurling, Gaelic football, rugby, tennis.
What were you best at?
Well, I thought I was best at hurling and I wanted to play hurling for Tipperary when I was young. Nicky English taught me in school, secondary school. He lived quite close to me at home.
Does he think you could have made it?
I doubt it. I think he'd laugh at that now. No, I was very close to being part of the under-14 Tipperary hurling team that went to the Tony Forrestal tournament in Waterford.
And was rugby big in your world then? Were you watching the Irish internationals? Were you?
I was. Rugby was the old Five Nations was always big in our house, and I played rugby all right from very young age. So I was probably three or four sports that just continuously played, but rugby was always there because my dad and my uncles played rugby and were involved with the local club in Clanwilliam and Tipperary. So
there was a period before it all got very, very serious and became professional when you were juggling Clanwilliam and Shannon as well. And it's mad to say it, but it wouldn't be unknown for you to play three matches in a weekend. Two on one day, one the next day. I don't know, like, you must be in bits.
I just took it kind of block by block, match by match. That two games in a Saturday was fine. There was no such thing as player welfare then. And, you know, I often scored two tries for the under-20s and scored another try for Shannon and scored another try or two on Sunday for Clanwilliam. And Sunday evening, then I'd be having a few drinks and looking back at the weekend saying it was great and that they all went pretty well. And, you know, you didn't always win them. And it didn't happen every weekend, but most weekends it was two games. You know, it was a Saturday-Sunday scenario. And they were all as important as each other. As you know, Clanwilliam's game was massive on a Sunday. The Shannon game was big for me because I was trying to make my name there. If it was with the 20s, whatever, they were all big games. And I enjoyed them and didn't really know any different. And that's just the way it was.
Would you have been happy enough to be a mechanic the rest of your days?
Yeah, I think I loved it. I think when I finished school, I did my leaving cert on Friday and I started an apprenticeship on Monday. I knew in 1997, obviously rugby went professional after the World Cup in 95, and I knew in 97 it was kind of, there was going to be 20 to 30 contracts in Munster, and I was playing with Shannon through that period, and, you know, I was being touted as getting involved with Munster, and so I gave up my job 6 months before the summer in 97. I gave it up December 1996. I gave up my job. Everyone said, you're crazy, you're giving up your job. Going into the unknown, who knows anything about professional rugby. But I kind of backed myself, and I remember talking to my mum and dad, and they were very relaxed with it because I'd qualified as a mechanic at that stage. And in fairness, the boss man at the time, maybe he wanted to get rid of me anyway, I don't know. But he said to me, look, if it doesn't work out, he loved his rugby too, Jerry Pearce and Arthur Pearce, who were two brothers. Arthur was a famous golfer, and they said to me, look, if it doesn't work out, you can come back. So I went selling, in that period, I went, you know, my mum would give me the car, I'd drive into Shannon a couple of times a week, play a game with them at the weekend. They would give me travelling expenses, and then I was selling lotto tickets for the rugby club. And then I was getting my stamps. Mm. So I was getting probably 150 quid a week as a full-time trainer, probably as much as I was as my wages as a mechanic. So, and I felt I wasn't losing anything, and I was giving myself a chance to prepare for those first contracts and train full-time and play really well for Shannon and grab the attention of Munster. I signed a part-time contract that summer which was £7,500 at the time, and match fees. And it was more, if I get, I looked at all the Munster games, I said, if I get X number of games, I'll get to 12, 14 grand a year, which was more than what I was going to get as a mechanic. So it's not a big deal for me here to do this, and I'm getting a great opportunity. And so that's the way it kind of started out. And
this is a time where, like, the provincial system as we know it now is quite new, you know, games every week, and that this is the team now, you know, it's not your clubs are drifting out to sea a touch in terms of your priorities. Where it probably struck a lot of people that Munster had something very special going on was in that 99-2000 season, where you reached your first Heineken Cup final. You beat Toulouse in the semi-final away, and thousands travel. You know, it's almost the first time that actually there's something a bit special going on here. So those early memories, that period where you realise what Munster is becoming, must have been unbelievably exciting.
Yeah, it was unbelievably exciting. I think it was, there's some contrast from the start of that season to the end, where we're in Twickenham, we lose the final against Northampton, and, you know, there's 40,000 Munster people there. You go right back to, I think it was round two where we played, or round two or three where we played Saracens over in Vicarage Road, and we probably had 20 supporters there.
Right. And so that's the season where it blows up then, is it?
Yeah, we were, and most of them were the parents.
Yeah.
The game was, and it was a Sunday evening against Saracens over in Vicarage Road. It wasn't on TV. Lendon Ean was doing it in Limerick 95, Limerick Live 95. And I remember thinking, you know, we won that game. We came back incredibly against Saracens in Vicarage Road. And that was the start of something special as regards we can do better than just beat a big team in Thomond Park. We can now go on the road. And, you know, we won for the first time that year in France. And we started to achieve things that we won the Interpros, and it kind of brought us right up to that semi-final where you know, this quarter-final Stade Francais at home, the semi-final against Toulouse, where we had these guys up on a pedestal that there was littered with French internationals. They looked bigger, they looked stronger, they looked fitter. And we were nobody really gave us a chance there, and winning that semi-final in Bordeaux was just incredible. And that was the start of maybe the fans going, this is something we want to be part of. Mm. Because it was a very precarious time, Joe, with the club scene and the provincial team, particularly in Limerick. You know, we had, when I played with Shannon, we had 8,000-10,000 people at every home game. It was, the Limerick derbies were ferocious. Great atmospheres going to Greenfields or to Garryowen, to Dourdale. And suddenly, you know, Shannon probably had 10 or 12 guys in the Munster team, and we were all internationals as well. And you go into the clubhouse in Shannon and all our jerseys are around the wall. They're incredibly proud of their international players. And in a year or two, we're gone. We can't play with the club. So it was a precarious time and position. And there was a bit of a divide there where, do we, you know, Munster are playing nearly every week now. And what about the club? And it affected the clubs, definitely. But that was the start of something really special, and we started to believe in that as well.
The final in 2000, Rog misses five kicks. He's 0 for 5. I don't know, had G2 overcome your differences at that stage, the early tension?
Oh, we had.
Your memory, so you said that often, you know, through your career, you would turn to him. That must have been devastating for him. I don't know, did he need some support from you guys then?
Yeah, he was pretty resilient, and a lot of mental strength. You know, Rog was never the biggest physical specimen of a man that played rugby. And I think most opposition teams tried to target him because of his physical size. But mental toughness and mental strength was a big plus for him. So he wasn't broken after that. He was very disappointed for sure. You know, I would have had a conversation, you know, but he probably didn't need the same attention that I would have needed if it was me.
Okay.
Which is a sign of his strength. So I think he put it behind him, like, and you know, he got loads of kicks before that and after that that people didn't expect him to get. But you have days like that as a kicker, and it could have been different if he got those kicks.
Munster came back again. They got to the final in 2002. We have the footage here of the infamous moment where Neil Back's hand does his thing. So, second to final defeat in 3 years. This is getting a little bit painful and a bit too much of a habit for you lot.
Yeah, and that was a game where, like, obviously there's loads of English internationals, big names, Johnson, Back, Moody, Austin Healy, all these guys, seasoned internationals, and Martin Corrie, and this was the Neil Back incident, which I was on the other side of the scrum and didn't really realise it happened so quickly, and we had David Wallace in at number 8 and we were going to launch him off the back of the scrum, and he was incredibly quick, Wally, and it was a great chance for us. If we scored there, we could have won the game. I think it was 15-9 at that stage, and we needed to score a try. But for me personally, I didn't dwell on it too much afterwards and go, well, he cost us a European Cup, because they were an incredibly strong team. We knew going into that final we had to stop their forwards. And as a pack of forwards for Munster, we had to stop them. They destroyed a lot of teams that campaign with their maul and their strength and power up front. And we did that pretty well. We made a couple of mistakes in the game. For their first try, we lost the line out, which always kind of irks me. And, Austin Healy slipped between Rog and Jason Holland for the try that he scored. So we did so many things right in that game, and just their bit of experience and quality told in the end, and we just came up short again, which was disappointing. But I never looked at Neil Back and said, you cost us the European Cup with any...
No.
And I don't think he did, but it still was wrong what he did. But I probably thought to myself, I'd do the same thing myself.
I'm sure you would. So the other thing to kind of state, even for younger viewers, is there's a kind of magic now about Munster in the Heineken Cup. You've reached two finals. You're against the all, trips to France, trips to England. Irish rugby's starting to blossom again. Golden generation are in off the back of a bad decade in the 90s. The possibilities are starting to grow. And then, 2003, the miracle match, for instance. We've some footage here of the scenes. And it'll give people an idea of the sort of romanticism that was in the air and the magic in the air. And look at Thomond Park there. So there were mad things happening.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. And I think... that whole journey and that togetherness was obviously very important to us, but it was also important to the people who supported Munster and who really bought into this journey and these wonderful days in Thomond Park and games on the road.
Dunnock is happy there.
Yeah. Jim Williams joins in with him there, but that was a special day. That's one that, of course, that stands out, because we'd lost Gloucester, hammered us in round one, and then we lost to Perpignan a week before this game, and effectively, we won 3, lost 2, and we had to win this one to have any chance. And we didn't really realise the permutations beforehand, that it was 27 points. And I think we were as shocked as some of the people in the sideline. But I remember Golov the night before, he gave us a speech in the hotel, and he was crying. And it really kind of hit home to us the position we were in, to be able to put on the Munster jersey and play in this iconic venue for this club. And, he was phenomenal. There was a lot of talk about game plans and stuff like that, but Golov really kind of made us feel like that we had a responsibility to go out and produce a performance that day. Not just win the game, but produce a performance full of pride and passion.
It's funny you say he was crying and emotional, because one of the things we hear about the first final in 2000 is that you all got a bit too emotional the night before. Talked about what Munster meant to you all, and there's tears, and maybe there's a flatness the next day as a result. Who knows? You may still have lost the game.
People look back at that, Joe, and they think, it was questioned, were we too emotional?
Yeah.
I think we were beaten by a better team.
Okay.
Just small margins on the day. It was our first final. Of course, we might have froze a little bit, but I don't think it was that to do with
the emotion.
Tears in the dressing room the night before, in the hotel.
Because I was going to say,
I'm
surprised you're still 2-3 years on, still in tears the night before.
But Golov had an ability to cry and inspire rather than make you emotional. And he was an incredible captain.
Yeah.
And like I say, he was a spiritual leader for so many of us. You remember the picture, the Irish picture with Rog and Stringer at either side. Golov gave you a comfort that it'll be all fine, it'll be great on the day, and just make sure that you deliver with passion and pride and give it everything. And he just had a really brilliant ability to do that.
Because I do remember this period and this team as an emotional team, like in touch with the passion, tears, you know, so you and could
probably,
see that, that
probably
was
a bit of a chip
were
on our shoulders
oh,
as well.
Listen, you know, nothing surer.
Backs to the wall stuff, and we love that. We love the fact, and Axel used to always talk about having a chip on our shoulder, and in a good way. That, and a lot of teams probably didn't rate us. I remember talking to French guys since I've retired, saying, you know, they couldn't figure out this monster phenomenon, why we could go and, you know, produce these kind of performances and what was special. It was something different because I think if you took the 15 players that took the field at any stage, we always knew we weren't as talented as some of the bigger teams with the bigger budgets. But we felt if we played together that we could break them. We could break the opposition with a relentless kind of drive and ability to hold on to the ball and just putting pressure on the opposition. We were probably a nightmare to play against because we were probably in your face all the time and just upsetting the opposition from playing and going after the out half who was can win a game or lose a game for you, that kind of a scenario. So I think we were a nuisance probably to play against.
Some new faces start coming through. You know, Paul O'Connell, we saw Donegal O'Callaghan there. It culminates in 06 and 08. Two Heineken Cups in 3 years. Phenomenal achievement. Injury costs you 06 a bit, but you do get on for the final. And then 2008, we have footage here of even the celebrations and just the sense of dominance, I think. You got man of the match in 08 in this final. So that must be incredibly satisfying for you.
Yeah, I think the most important thing for me, and I know people say this after they get the man of the match situation, I wasn't the best Munster player in the field that day. But I did fine, I played okay. But the most important thing for me was in obviously in 06, I had the injury in at the start of that year and I got back for 3 or 4 minutes at the end of the 06 final. I was the happiest sub ever. But this was me feeling I played throughout the whole campaign. I performed really well in a lot of the games. And this was in the back of the 07 World Cup. Yeah. So this was the fitness, the conditioning that I put in enabled me to do that. So, you know, I was back here in my own head and here I was. I played an important part right throughout the campaign and right up to that final. So it was really special. 06 was getting back from my knee and, like I said, they were both really, really special. I was the happiest sub ever in 06 and this was me playing a full part. I just was trying to take it all in, really. I couldn't believe that. Because I thought 06, oh God, it's a pity. I'm here and it's great and I've played in loads of the other finals and the semi-finals and loads of disappointments, but I have the medal now in 06, but 08, I've contributed right the way through and I've played, you know, I've put in some great performances as well, which was really satisfying and gratifying at the end.
It can't get much sweeter, really, you know, as the season goes 08 for you, you know, to contribute that way and for it to finish the way it finished. And I would say, actually, not to be unfair to the 06 team, but 08, that team played some great rugby. I mean, Dougie Howlett's suddenly part of this back line and there's some brilliant tries scored across that season. So it's ticking a lot of boxes.
Yeah, Maffey Tupoke here there as well. And they give you a different dimension. You know, you put Sean Payne and Trevor Halstead in the 06 team and we were probably more of a direct team there. Trevor Halstead was just phenomenal. You know, John Kelly played at outside centre in that final. He was brilliant. And, you know, so we probably didn't have the same cutting edge as 08. But you need to get better. And we learned that in 07 when we lost the quarterfinal away to the Scarlets. We were European champions. We were out of Europe in the quarterfinals. Mm. We had a big sit-down at the start of that season and we had to raise our standards again.
I struggle to think of many teams who had the bond that your team had and the extent to which that bond has survived. We're talking genuine friendships here. And maybe it's because a lot of you are all from the same neck of the woods. Maybe it's because you created this thing almost out of nothing from the late 90s on. And I know even your parents are part of this as well. Like you mentioned, one of those early trips to Saracens on a Sunday night. It's basically just your parents in the crowd. Like, so ye have your thing going on as a group. And even the parents formed a little bit of a cabal as well.
Yeah, and that was lovely for us as players that our parents enjoy these trips. And, you know, some of the trips to south of France, you know, another game we played Saracens at 7:30 on a Saturday night in not on TV anywhere. In the south of France. We played Cass, I should say. And I remember that one as well, but they're on the charter plane with us. So the players are the front of the plane and there's 25 or 30 parents at the back of the plane.
So you'd know all the parents, would you?
Yeah, we got to know them over the years, and should they'd be on the same plane, and our parents became very close. I think the whole bond revolves around it being unique, Joe, because there's so many brilliant Munster players that played ever before any of us. Mm. There's so many guys who didn't get to play in that 06 or 08 final that were very much part of it in our minds. Like Claude didn't get to play in the final, or Golov, Killian Keane, you know, Jim Williams, these guys who came in, John Langford, Woody came in 99, 2000. So many players before us, and guys who were squad players and incredibly important as well. And you look at the history of Munster going back to beating the All Blacks, beating Australia, so many wonderful players. We knew that responsibility because we got that from Claw and Golov and people who came in and spoke to us over the years. So we were kind of representing them all. But our story was a bit unique because rugby went professional, European Cup came into play, and this whole journey started. So it was new. Mm. It was new. And I think we learned and grew together as... We got old together as well.
Yeah. And would the parents have stayed in touch?
Absolutely. You know, my mum and dad would have been great friends with everyone. My dad has passed away last year now, and they were very, very close. And all the parents become very, very close to the point that they still go to games, and they still stay in touch with each other, still organise trips, and they still go to the games. And my mum loves doing that. And that was very special. And when my dad passed away, it was incredible because not alone were my teammates coming in, but the parents were as well. And that's what makes it special, you know. And it's a very difficult situation because, you know, I was very, very close to my dad. And, you know, someone asked me recently, are you over that? And I didn't know how to answer it because it's something... You know, I can never get over.
I think as well, when Anthony Foley passed away, we got a glimpse of the closeness of the team when part of the mourning was quite public. And you could see this was not just, you know, a team coming back to remember a teammate. This was family, you know. And you know, I think even listening to you the last couple of minutes, I have a deeper understanding of why that was.
Yeah, I remember going in playing under-20s with Shannon and looking at Anthony Foley and thinking, he's massive. This is this famous schools player who's achieved so much. I'm this skinny guy coming in from Tipperary and I'm standing beside him and just being in awe of him. Mm. And then just playing alongside him in the under-20s back row for Shannon. Brendan was our coach with Shannon, and we went and won the Munster League, the Limerick League and the Limerick Cup that year, the three cups that you could win at under-20s. And that was the first kind of... involvement I had with Anthony and obviously playing with him for so long, playing with Shannon, Munster and Ireland. And then when that happened, obviously, it was shocking, really. Mm. To this day, it still feels the same. And I think there was comfort in the fact that we could all come together. And, you know, we spent that night, the night he was buried in Killaloe in the hotel, and the conversations, the stories were comforting for everybody. Mm. I think they were comforting for Brendan and Sheila and for Olive and Rosie and Orla as well. But people still couldn't get their head around it, you know. It had a profound effect on everyone that this is not right. You know, this shouldn't happen. And I know lots of people maybe watch this and have been affected with losing loved ones and losing their own children, which is incredibly difficult. And that's why, you know, I always said it about my dad, and I said it at the funeral, at his funeral, that you can't give out to the man above if your parents or if you as an individual get into your 80s and you've had a fair crack at it. And unfortunately, that didn't happen for Anthony, and it's the same for lots of people who are like that. So sometimes it makes no sense, and there was no sense to that whole situation. But there was a little bit of comfort there that people loved him so much and cared for him so much and cared for the family. And, you know, my mum would still talk to Sheila and Brendan a lot. And it's an incredibly difficult situation for Olive and for the family with what happened to Anthony. And we don't ever forget him. We often have conversations about him. And It was just madness what happened. Mm.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
It should have been a real bonus year for you as a 34-year-old going on the Lions tour to South Africa. 8 Munster players picked. You know, it was extraordinary. There were a whole bunch of Irish. I mean, that was an Irish tour in many ways. Ireland had won the Grand Slam. Leinster and Munster were playing in a Heineken Cup semi-final, as we'll come to. And you were almost one of those kind of, geez, what a lovely story at 34 years of age. You know, he hasn't played for Ireland this calendar year. And he's been picked for the Lions because he's been in good form and he'll be a good tourist and all the reasons, I'm sure, that the coach has had. And we know you don't go, and we know this had a profound effect on you. So Heineken Cup semi-final is the moment. Would you call it a moment of madness? Moment of what?
I don't know if I'd call it a moment of madness because I've said this probably a good few times. There was no conscious decision in my mind. It looks terrible in slow motion for sure, but there was no conscious decision in my mind to go, I'm going to try and gouge someone here.
Do you remember it?
Yeah, I remember it because I remember that Paul had the ball and Leo had him around the neck, and I was trying to grab Leo by the jersey and pull him back upwards because I had lifted Paul in the line-out. And I knew that I'd made contact with his face, but that's why I say it wasn't.
Because it looks bad in slow motion. Yeah, I would look at it in slow motion and I couldn't say for sure you're trying to gouge somebody. That's a big accusation. But it looks like, well, I know his face is there and I know where my hand is and I'll give it a rub somewhere.
I tell you what went through my head and trying to explain it is difficult. I tried to grab him by the jersey and lift him backwards and pull him, Leo, back upwards. And that didn't happen. My hand went across his face and in slow motion, it looks like it's 5 seconds, but it was 0.4 of a second. The reason I know this is because I was clutching at straws trying to defend myself, and we got a company in England to kind of break down the video and time how long it was and how quick my hand went across his face. Mm. And, you know, Sky showed it a number of times in replays, and I didn't realise that until I came off the field. And George Murray, our video analyst, said, look, Sky, after showing this, it's you may have a problem here. And he showed it to me 2 minutes after we went in off the field. And even though I had that kind of dreaded feeling in my stomach that it may be picked up, I was convinced then that's it, my Lions tour is over. Right from that moment, yeah. I was convinced that's over because I can't. They won't understand what was going through my head here, and I didn't mean this, and I didn't mean to do it to him. And, you know, I said that, you know, one of the things that went against me in the hearing was, well, why did you go up and apologise to Leo?
It's funny, I was just about to say that to you. I was about to say, well, even clearly before you heard from the backroom staff member that Sky Sports had shown this a lot, and they had shown it a lot, it's clear you went up to Leo Cullen to say, either I didn't mean it, it's an accident, sorry, are we all good? So that would suggest a feeling of guilt on your part even before you'd seen it.
Well, when my hand came across his face and came across his eye, he kind of swatted my hand away and shouted up at me. And literally at that moment, I said, look, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. We end up running away. Okay. So I wanted to kind of make sure the game is lost for us. Mm. They won, and the disappointment of that is big in itself. But I just wanted to say, look, Leo and myself would have clashed a few times over the years. We actually got on really well because we played a lot of games for the Ireland A team together and we had fun. We had crack nights out and we were in a lot of Irish squads and we were quite similar in a sense that we were periphery players for Ireland for a number of years.
Yeah.
So we would have been the bag holders and we would have had a bit of crack and fun. So I just wanted to say, look, that was an accident. I didn't mean to do that. It wasn't my intention.
Mm.
And he laughed it off. I think if you see the end of that, he accepted that straight away. So then I went into the dressing room and George said that to me. And I knew straight away. I said, look, if it's played over a number of times in Sky, it'll be picked up. I'm a controversial pick for the Lions anyway because, I don't think the English media were best pleased. Tom Croft was an England international. I was picked ahead of him. And I was a kind of a left field selection, really, based on that quarter final for Munster against Ospreys and Thomond Park, because I sat in the stand throughout the Six Nations. I was with Ireland throughout that whole Grand Slam campaign, and you know, you got to play in the Six Nations, in my opinion, to be picked in the Lions. And I a few times I kind of went, oh God, particularly over in Murrayfield, Ireland played Scotland. I'm sitting in the stand, Ian McGeoghegan and Warren Gatland are behind me to watch the game to see how they play. And I thought, God, if I was on the field, maybe they'd be watching me. And then I said, no, that's not me.
So on the train home, I know you've spoken about how there's a numbness setting in because, the lads are having a few drinks and getting over the defeat to Leinster, but you're realising there's a good chance my Lions tour is over here. News comes through, 12-week ban, tour gone, this amazing thing. You know, like you talk about dreaming to play for Ireland. To play for the Lions is just different level and it's such a great tour. The South African tour, even in hindsight, it's looked back on as one of the great tours to have been on. That's all taken from you. I mean, you're really spiral here. This isn't, it was disappointing and sure, look, I went away for a few weeks and I got on with it. This is like culminating that year and having to get professional help, level of disappointment.
Yeah, I think... I mentioned the highs and lows at the start of being a professional athlete and winning and losing and all that stuff. And it's all part of sport. For any kid, you're disappointed when you lose, you're delighted when you win. That doesn't change all the way up. Obviously, the consequences and the severity and the magnitude of matches changes and the tournaments you play in. And when you're getting paid to play a sport, there's more pressure. I just felt at the end of my career, coming towards the end of my career, this was a reward for probably some of the perseverance and the setbacks and the knocks that I had taken and the determination and the discipline I'd shown off the field to get back and recover and get myself fit again and get myself going and motivated. And this is it. Good things happen when you keep digging in there and then it's gone. And I feel it's self-inflicted because it's my actions that's taken it away. And I think that's why I spiraled to the level I did because, Tomás got injured and missed a tour. Tomás O'Leary, Gerry Flannery missed a tour, got injured. And I looked at their situation. I said, well, that's bad luck. They can accept it. They're just really unlucky. Whereas I blamed myself so much more. And I was angry with myself. And I was feeling, why does this have to happen to me again? Mm. Why do I have to feel this bad over something again? It's easier not to be on the stage than be on the stage and put yourself in a potential position like that. So am I better off just giving up rugby now and never doing this again because it's too risky? I can't feel like this. I don't want to be this high, this low. And this was a low that I'd never experienced. Obviously, everybody has ups and downs in life and you have disappointments and setbacks with all parts of life. And that's part of that's you've got to deal with that. But I felt that this was kind of self-inflicted. And maybe it was the negativity that was a bit of negativity that was in me that I had this jubilation for a couple of weeks. And I felt I let myself go and let myself be free that life is wonderful. It can be wonderful. And now it's gone, it's different. And this is just more than a match. This is just more than a Lions tour. This is the way it's supposed to be. I convinced myself that it's just something good will happen and then it'll be bad. And that was the most frustrating and situation for me. And I didn't want people to feel sorry for me. So I didn't really show any emotion. My son was only a couple of months old and he gave me good strength, and my wife at the time helped me a lot, and she had to live with that. Mm. And I had a little boy and I'd go off walking in the buggy with him, and I'd look in at him and think, that's the bit of strength that I need. He's going to keep me going, and I have to get strong again. Because, you know, when you have a disappointment, Joe, of course you feel sad. Everyone experiences disappointments, but it's probably the magnitude of how you catastrophize them in your own head, if that makes sense, that this was the end of the world. Like, how am I going to come back from this? How can I go and do this level of fitness again? Where's my motivation going to come from? I've just destroyed something that was could have been so wonderful for me. I was envious going home on the train that night. I looked at my teammates who were disappointed in losing a massive game. I was craving to be at their level of disappointment, not at my level of disappointment, which was through the floor. They even a bit of a sing song started on the train. They were having a few drinks, and that's you just got to get on with life when it's sport, and there's no blame game in that. We just better team beat us in the day. We underperform, whatever way you want to look at it. But I wanted to jump out of that train. I didn't want to be alive. I didn't want to be alive at that moment, because I said I cannot deal with this, and I didn't mean it. I didn't intentionally do this. But I blame myself for the action, which was, it was really reckless.
When does it get to a point where you even say, actually, I'm so not snapping out of this, I need to go and talk to someone about
it? Yeah. Well, I went to my doctor, which, you know, Mick Shinkwin, who would have been our doctor for a number of years, and had conversations with him and tried to understand why I'm not getting better, and that it was pretty serious. I couldn't sleep, I had no motivation, and then JP O'Donoghue, the other doctor with Munster as well, I had conversations with both of them, and they helped, and I think they realised that there was something serious going on here. It wasn't just, he'll get over this. So I needed some intervention, I needed to talk to someone about it, and it wasn't just it was everything that was getting in on top of me, and I found that motivation was hard to come by again, you know, because it was such a big thing for me, you know. When you work so hard and put so much time and effort and sacrifice into being the best you can be, none of us do it at all perfect, you know. And I just found it hard to get any motivation to do anything again. And so I needed some help and intervention, and gradually I started to rebuild myself a little bit again, and I suppose speak about that trauma, frustration, that negative voice that probably has always been there, that anxiety, the maybe suffering a bit with depression, and understand myself a lot better. And stop blaming myself, really, that it felt like the end of the world, but it wasn't the end of the world.
Yes.
And you know, that's the hard thing to articulate to people at the time. And I felt, if I talk about this, well, people would say, just get on with it and you'll be fine. But that wasn't going to work. You know, I had to go deeper and find out, how can I show emotion with this? How can I let it bleed, if you like? And then try and let it heal. And, you know, so there was a process there, and it took a long time. And we went, Ruth and myself, and AJ, our son, was only, you know, 6 months at that time. And all my friends were planning to go to South Africa. They were all booked in. They told their wives that they had to go. They were blaming me. They thought they have to go to South Africa. He's picked in this tour. There was, in the local pub in where I lived in Castletroy, there was, we had a, the night it was announced, they had a bit of a get-together there, and all the lads had to ring their wives and stuff and say they have to go to South Africa, and that was all gone. But my cousin got married in Las Vegas, and you know, obviously I told him I couldn't go because the lines was on. He knew. And that all changed then where, you know, we decided I would go to go to the wedding. And that was great for a week to go there. And we brought the little fella as well. And my mum came as well. And she was babysitting in Las Vegas for a week for us. And we had a great time. And it got rid of the...
Yeah.
It helped, but then it came back pretty much straight away when I came home and reality hit again. So it took a long time. I would still say I'll never be over it. I'll never be over the disappointment to that. And again, it's not looking for any sort of sympathy for people, but it was a big moment, you know. It was, you're either a British and Irish Lion or you're not.
No, it's a big loss. And not to over kind of just park that disappointment, but if there is any silver lining, listening to you now and even at various other points over the last decade, it seems that that disappointment and the fallout prompted you to look at some of your thinking habits, the negativity, the anxiety, to address some of them. And you strike me now as someone who worked on yourself, interrogated yourself and developed as a human being maybe. And that 2009 disappointment seems to have been one which forced you to do that a little bit. So if there is some silver lining, maybe that's it.
Yeah, some people said that, look, some good will come out of it and things happen for a reason and stuff. And I found it so hard to go back to training that summer and even having the conversation with Tony McGahan. You know, I had to go through the doctor at the time because I couldn't talk to him over the phone and I was dreading going back and I wasn't ready to go back. So it took a couple of weeks to actually go back and yeah, I suppose... I always thought I was strong physically, that I could, no matter who stood in front of me in a rugby field, that they wouldn't scare me or frighten me. Or if you physically challenged me, no matter who you were, I would fight and I would be strong and I wasn't scared or afraid. But emotionally, I realised I was weak and... It was causing me issues and it has caused me issues and probably still does to this day that I needed to figure myself out a little bit better. And I suppose everybody kind of emotionally struggles at times and, you know, has different outlooks in life and different challenges that affect them differently. And I didn't really have a balance, you know, and I looked at the whole... I never wanted to delve into mental health because I didn't want to go there. I didn't want to kind of, you know, I didn't know anything about it. But when you're at a point where you feel like your world has ended and then you look into a pram and you see a six-month-old boy looking up at you and you think, I've got to be strong for him, you know?
Mm.
And... And that was a big challenge. But, you know, I was able to kind of process it. I suppose you have to process the disappointment of that and try and deal with it. And I suppose if you've any problem or challenge in life, the best way to deal with it is to try and get help or support. But that's the problem around mental health, Joe, I think, is, you know, people do kind of bottle up their trauma and their strife. And I was probably in the habit of all my life of never sharing any sort of emotion or worries or fears. And that's not a good way to be. That's what I've probably learned out of it, that it doesn't mean that you won't get difficulties or challenges in your life, that it's just how you deal with them and how you try and find a solution. You may never get the perfect reality, because sometimes reality is difficult for people in life, whether you're playing sport or whatever you're doing in your life. Sometimes people have been, and I've met lots of people since I started talking a little bit about mental health that have had really tough situations and tough lives and far worse situations than I ever have. You know, I count myself blessed that I've had a wonderful life, but I think sometimes 5 or 10% of negativity can engulf that 90% positivity. It's very, very powerful. So I've learned to at least understand that you know, there's better ways of dealing with your trauma than kind of bottling it up, and it's become probably easier for people to have conversations nowadays, and there's more acceptance that if you do have whatever kind of situation that's been tough in your life or your reality is difficult, that there may be a bit of light at the end of the tunnel if you try and get some help or assistance with something. And you know, I get emotional there talking about my son, but, and like I said, you know, he gave me great strength because I had to kind of get strong again, not just for my son, of course, for my rest of my family as well. And you know, I'm glad I did. It was a tough situation because lots of people, I found there was a sense of shame with it as well, because, you know, I did play rough and abrasive at times, and I was confrontational, and I just didn't want to be defined. This is it. People are just going to say I'm an eye gouger. That's my career, and that hurt me more than anything. That this is what I've created this at right towards the end of my career. But funnily enough, the last 2 years that I had were probably, they were as enjoyable as the ones I were winning, because I got more relaxed and I realised that it wasn't the end of the world, and that there's more to life than sport, and there's more to life than, you know, there's a lot more to life, and there's a lot more brilliant things. But you become very programmed as a professional athlete as well. You know, it's, you become selfish, you become hard to live with maybe, you become narky. It's relentless at times, and maybe you have to have that relentlessness with it. But for anyone that would ask me anytime about it now, about my career, I would say it's not the end of the world. You just try and do the best you can in that particular moment, and if you need a bit of help or assistance, talk to people and get that out there.
Alan Quinlan, that's a fine point to finish on. Been nice chatting to you.
Thanks, Joe. Pleasure.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.